This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
This is the show trainers listen to. Welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, joined in studio by my producer Lee Delapina, as always, here for the next hour, and really looking forward to this visit here tonight. You know, this show this evening really epitomizes what Trainer Talk is all about and the reasons for creating this show, because both of our guests tonight are people who have had so much success already in the business, and I'm sure much more ahead, but their backgrounds, their careers, how they were raised, just amazing. Going to talk with trainer Carlos Martin in the first half of the program, and Jimmy Islin will be with me in the second half of the show tonight here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Without further ado, let's get right to it. Carlos Martin has conditioned 601 career winners, totaling more than $21.5 million in purses. He has one of the strongest trainer pedigrees in the book. He's the grandson of Hall of Fame trainer Frank Martin. He's the son of Jose Martin, who conditioned three Eclipse champions in Lakeville Miss, Wayward Lass, and the brilliant sprinter Groovy. And Carlos is with me here tonight on Trainer Talk. Carlos, welcome to Trainer Talk.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to have you here. And, you know, interesting, your dad trained one of my favorite horses as I was growing up around the tracks in New York, a little horse by the name of Key Contender.
Yeah, that was a good story. That was a 1995, and Mr. Lizza, who had been a client of ours for many years, kind of was going through a little bit of a lull after having so much success with Noble National, where it would last in the 80s, and I saw the horse in the sale, and I kind of was bugging them to buy the horse, and everybody was like, "Man, you're not going to go over there and buy a 7-year-old from Mac Miller, great Hall of Fame trainer, are you?" And I said, "Well, we have nothing going on. The stable's a little quiet. Let's take a shot and see what we could do." So I got Dad and Mr. Lizza there, and I think they paid $170,000 for the horse out of the back then it used to be the old time sale that they used to have at Belmont, Horses of Racing Age, towards the end of the year, kind of for the cast off. So he was an unusual horse when they were trying to get out of the business right around that time period. So Mr. Lizza had a leap of faith, paid $170,000, and we got the horse, and we got lucky enough to finish second in a big race behind you and I, Bobby Frankel's horse, and the Brooklyn Handicap, and then come right back and win the Suburban. So it was like a dream come true to make that happen as a 7-year-old horse to win a Grade One in New York.
What did you like about him? What made you go over there?
Well, he was, like I said, a hard-knocking horse. Mr. Miller, as great a trainer as he was, very conservative, would run him in all those handicaps, and the horse had some huge speed figures. You know, and he was a chance to get a classy Rockabye, you know, Paul Mellon bred horse. You know, you don't see those too often be given away at a public auction with his race record. And it was a little bit of a gamble because people were figuring that Mr. Miller probably squeezed the lemon dry and there was nothing left in the tank. But I had confidence that between me and my dad, we worked together and we'd try to get the horse in some spots where there were big races, but maybe you catch some of the heavy heads, you know, sleeping or maybe not at their best, and take a shot in some of those bigger races that they were reluctant to do. They would always run them in these handicaps and allowance races and these condition races, and the horse was running huge numbers and huge figures showing, you know, races that were good enough to maybe compete in the Grade One. So we took a shot, and I said, "Let's take a shot and buy him and see if we can get him in some of those big races." We took him to Hialeah, and we went down there for the Widener, and he was training sensational, but he flipped his pallet, and he ran dead last that day, and everybody was so disappointed. And old man Kelly was saying, "Forget about all those stupid surgeries. Just put two tongue ties on him and try to get him to settle, and he'll run better for you." So I told Dad, and he thought I was a little nuts, and we put a figure eight and a double tongue tie, and next thing you know, he was second in the Brooklyn and won the Suburban. So from dead last in the Widener, he sure made up for it the subsequent starts after that.
Wow, that's such a great story. And I mentioned your pedigree and your family. This was obviously something that was in your blood from a very young age. What was it like growing up in such a prestigious racing family, Carlos?
Well, it was definitely interesting having my grandfather, you know, his attitude and the way he did things, and my dad are a little bit different. My grandfather was, you know, such a stern taskmaster, and he was brilliant at what he did, but he was really, you know, nose to the grindstone. My dad kind of, I grew up more with him, and he was able to, you know, spend more time, and my grandfather would never talk too much. You'd have to just watch him and keep up with him 7 days a week at 4 o'clock in the morning if you wanted to learn, where my dad, of course, I was always with him. So, you know, it was interesting to go between the both of them, but definitely my dad also was a great trainer. He trained a lot of grade one horses, and he was good with the good horse as far as management and stuff like that. So I learned a little bit about both from them. Basically, my grandfather, his name was made more with claimers than he developed into good horses. So there's a little bit of a different style there of training. They're both great at what they did, and they both accomplished a lot. But my father was really my big, you know, instrument in the horse racing. He was always close and very supportive. And when I was 7 years old, I got to go to the track and watch Lakeville Miss dominate the Coaching Club American Oaks. So I said, this must be, you know, drink champagne and win a grade one. It sounds like all fun and games at 7 years old. So I kind of got hooked from that day on.
Is that when you knew you wanted to follow in their footsteps that young?
Well, no, for sure. But I mean, you know, it's such an experience, you know, to go to the races and then, you know, see such a great horse and win a grade one at Belmont, and just the whole excitement get wrapped up around it. Obviously now, all these years later, you realize Lakeville Misses and Groovies and Wayward Lasses and Noble Nashes don't grow on trees. So it's a difficult game. You know, you have to be lucky to get those kind of horses. And for whatever reason, besides being great with young horses, my dad would have an uncanny ability. Every year he'd get horses that were modestly bred and horses that maybe people didn't think much of, or for whatever reason in a sale or bought back out of a sale. And every year he'd come up with it seemed like a grade one or a grade two horse for horses that were being bought for $30,000, $40,000 or homebreds or something. He was very, very fortunate that way.
As a kid, would you spend most of your time at the track, or were there other sports or activities that you were involved with?
I went to a Catholic high school, St. Agnes, and I was big into running, and I loved the track. And my coach, you know, when I got really involved in the horse racing as a junior, you know, he said, don't even come to the meets. You know, you're so good, don't even come for the practices. Just show up for the meets. You're going to get a scholarship. But by that time, I was already hooked with the horses. I'm like, no, my weekends are going to be spent at Belmont Park University.
Would he ever ask you for any tips?
No.
What's your favorite memory of your grandfather?
My favorite memory of my grandfather was just the times we spent together after the barn, when I'd go to his house in Garden City, and we'd sit around, and he'd be in the fireplace by his house, and just talking about old stories and horses. And, you know, he loved to cook linguine and broccoli. He was a hell of a cook, and he'd get a bottle of wine and spend a couple of hours with him and telling stories. And, you know, away from the track, he was such a different personality. So I would enjoy going a couple of days a week on my dark days just to the house with him and Charlene here in Garden City, about 20 minutes from Belmont, and spending, you know, those afternoons with him, you know, just letting him discourse away about different things. Those were my best memories of him, just him and me alone in the house there, you know.
You know,
away from the racetrack.
He was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1981. What do you remember about that day?
I remember it was exciting. I was really, really young, and I didn't know a lot what was going on, you know, but it was, you know, Saratoga, you know, growing up there for all those years, and it was definitely an unbelievable experience, no question.
Talking with trainer Carlos Martin here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Sadly, Carlos, your dad left us way too early, and I can relate to that because, just like my dad, he lost a battle with lung cancer at a very young age of 63. My dad was the exact same age, and your dad passed away in 2006, 6 years before your grandfather would pass away. You were quoted after he died as saying he was a great father and a great friend. What was the most important thing he instilled in you?
Well, basically just to try to be honest and live your life, you know, and respect the people, you know, that you deal with and contact, and don't ever, you know, always try to be humble as a person, you know, and don't take anything for granted. You know, he was a very straightforward person, maybe a little bit too candid at times. You know, when he was a young man, he had some of these big Kentucky owners like the Evanses and Brownwell Combs, and he was rolling when he was 25 or 27 years old. He had Edward P. Evans, the Quality Road owner, and he would be, you know, telling them, we're not having any luck together. Mr. Evans would be like, Jose, we're doing fine. No, we're not having any luck together. You need to get yourself another trainer. I said, you're crazy. I used to tell him all those years later. I said, who throws out Edward P. Evans from the barn because they're not having any luck together? So he was a little bit extreme as far as whatever he felt in his heart, he'd lay it all on the table. And he lost a lot of good horses and a lot of good clients as well as he did, because he was maybe a little bit too candid, especially for this business. But he was always, you know, a guy that wore his heart on his sleeve, and he's always trying to do the best for the horses. And, you know, I remember him telling me the story in 81 when Noble Nash was going to make his debut at Belmont. and Mr. Liz, of course, from Flying Z Stable, the owner that we had for so many years. They had so much high hopes for the horse's first start, and the horse had pulled a muscle, so about 2 days before the race, you know, Dad said, we're not going to run. And Mr. Liz said, well, I had 50 people come into Belmont Park, and what do you mean you're not going to run? And he said, no problem. You can go to Belmont, go to the trustees' room, have champagne. He's not running. So he would take those kind of stands, and people would be like, oh, this guy, he's going to, you know, he didn't care about what anybody thought, but he ran he took care of the horses like he owned them himself, and he, you know, did what he thought was best for the horses. That was his number one priority all the time.
Are you kind of like that today when you're working with your clients?
I mean, I've probably lost a few owners probably being candid too, and a little bit like that. I mean, I think it's a little bit of a different, you know, generation, and with social media and stuff, and, you know, it's not like my grandfather and my father, where they thought they were just going to train the horses, and the only time the owners would know about the races is when they have to pick up the newspaper. Things have changed a little bit. So I got a little bit of that in me, but I think I'm more balanced to the new age, I would hope, anyway, if I want to stay in this business.
How about your grandfather? Was there anything you learned from him or that he really tried to teach you that you're still using today?
No, the main thing with him was just, you know, perseverance and stay with it. You know, he just, you know, every day, 7 days a week, and he'd have his routine, and he'd be up at 3:30 in the morning, and his wife would make him coffee at 4, and he'd be at the barn at 4:30, and, you know, just keep, you know, your eyes open. And see, check your horses, you know, morning, noon, and night. He was just a hard worker, and he knew the business, and he was just, you know, a guy who was very talented with horses with physical problems. But basically, the only thing you took from him is that his commitment to excellence, you know, just the 7 days a week, that he just loved it so much. It was never like, and no matter what trainers say, the best of them, you know, there's so many highs and lows. That can become a grind, especially when you don't have those great horses to look down the shed row. But he was always the same in his demeanor and the way he took his job.
Well, speaking of great horses, I mentioned at the top of the interview, Key Contender was one of my favorite horses in your dad's barn. Did you have a favorite in your father's or even your grandfather's barn when you were growing up?
Well, in 87, I was a little bit older, and I almost was like kind of the assistant when Dad had Groovy and Fiery Ensign and Goodbye Halo. We went with two out of the three to the Breeders' Cup, so I know I kind of got attached to Groovy, because when we first got Groovy in 86, he was a little bit of a laughing stock. He ran the fastest half mile, I think, in the Kentucky Derby history, and he was eased, and Dad was like the sixth trainer to have the horse in about a two-year span, and, you know, the horse was kind of a laughing stock, and Dad said, I'm going to take this horse and turn him into a champion, and everybody was laughing at him because the horse had just been eased in the Derby. So when he took him and made him a champion sprinter, and when Phone Trick came to town from California, was undefeated, and we were able to beat him in that year's Tom Fool, and then the rest was history. I think Dad won like 11 out of 17 with the horse. But it was an amazing story because the horse was kind of a laughingstock after being eased in the Kentucky Derby. So for him to turn him around, and I was with him a lot at that time, working with that horse every day, it was gratifying to see the horse, you know, come back after we took the chip out of the knee in 87. He came back and won 6 out of 7, second in the Breeders' Cup, Eclipse Award winner. You know, so that was a gratifying horse. That was probably my favorite horse.
Yeah, how
in
cool,
those times, Groovy.
How cool was it for you as a young kid growing up and just being a fan of the sport, being a fan of what your dad and your grandfather were doing, and maybe thinking, hey, this is what I want to do for a living, to be participating at least in some part in a race like the Kentucky Derby, and then to be part of the Breeders' Cup? That had to be so cool for you as a little kid.
Yeah, as a little kid, not that much in the Derby and stuff like that in 81. I was still kind of, you know, just walking hots and stuff. But in 87, going to California, you know, with Fiery Ensign after he won the Young American, Groovy after he won the Vosburgh and won the Forego, yeah, it was an exciting time, no question. And California, unfortunately, we didn't get it done. Very subtle, ran probably one of the greatest races, filly or male, in the sprint that year. And, you know, she beat us that day. And it was a little bit devastating. You know, I was 21 years old in California thinking there's no way he's going to lose. He's 6 for 6. What a great horse. They're not going to see which way he went. You know, he trained brilliantly. And then when Very Subtle beat him, it was like I didn't want to leave. Didn't want to get up in the morning for like a week. I was just devastated, you know, because, you know, you're thinking you're going to maybe get a Clips Award and Horse of the Year, you know, that year. And then we found out about a week later he had fractured a splint bone in the race, and then he was retired. So it was a lot of highs and lows like this business has.
You had a nickname given to you by the New York Press when you were in your teens?
Yeah, Mr. and Mrs. Wilson, I think, were the people that started that. My dad and my grandfather had horses for the people that owned a firm, Harborview Farm. They were very big, famous owners here back in the 80s and 90s, Lou Wilson and Patrice Wilson. And when I was a kid, we had the horses in the barn, and we got really friendly. So they named a horse named Computer Carlos. I would always spit out the pedigrees and all that stuff. So they thought that was kind of neat. So they named a horse after me.
Was that always your infatuation, was going through the pedigrees and looking at them and trying to come up with the best scenarios in that respect?
No, I just was very good at retaining things like that. Maybe not as good as the schoolwork, but I retained the pedigrees. So when anybody would mention a horse or a name or find out who the horse was by, so it kind of became a running joke in New York that, you know, I knew more about pedigrees than anybody else and all that stuff. But I don't know how much that helps you. If you don't have the money to go buy the right pedigrees or the right horses, it's a hard game. But I think sometimes I've been lucky and gotten edges. When I first started training and I claimed a horse from Mr. Steinbrenner by Affirmed because of my relationship with the Wolfsons, and I was the youngest trainer to win a grade one, and I claimed her because she was by Affirmed, obviously out of an old tartan family, intentionally mare called By the Hand, and I figured she's in for 32,000. How wrong can I go? And they had been running her in all kinds of different distances. So I claimed her out of a sprint, which I thought was crazy. And then I stretched her out. And then a year later, I won the grade one top flight handicap with Julie Crone. So sometimes the pedigrees definitely helped. It didn't hurt to know, you know, what was going on with that as far as that goes.
Well, it certainly helped you in a lot of different scenarios. You were kind of an instant success because you took out your trainer's license at, what, 19? And then 2 years later, you became the youngest trainer to win a grade one race in North America when you won the top flight handicap with By the Firm. Pretty cool story.
Yeah, it was amazing. Every year we'd go down to Florida, and Steinbrenner would have to give us the trophy for the champion Florida bred mare for like 3 years in a row. He was always so pissed off he'd send the farm manager to pick up the trophies. It was exciting times.
What was George Steinbrenner like to be around?
I really didn't have much contact with him. He just accepted those dinners. After I claimed his horse, I don't think he wanted to be around me too much.
Yeah, I wonder if he was as competitive with the horses as he was with the New York Yankees.
I think so. Like I said, By the Firm, I remember, had like three or four different trainers. George Gianos, the trainers from Pistol and Roses. Butch Lanzini, who trained Aloma's Ruler. Howie Tesher, who trained Tap Shoes and was an old New York trainer who's still training in Florida. So, yeah, Steinbrenner was pretty rough. I think he had four or five different trainers at that particular mare at the time when I claimed her, and that was another reason I figured, man, she probably would like to stay at one place for a little bit more than a month or two.
You know, I know trainers are always confident in their ability, and when you're getting started, it's not always easy, but can you imagine when you took out your trainer's license at 19 that 2 years later you'd be winning grade one races like that?
Yeah, I was really, really rolling, and I kind of, not that I got behind my dad's shadow a little bit after I was rolling because he got sick and stuff like that, but later on in those middle years where I was still young and having so much success, I kind of went almost private with Mr. Lizza and Flying Z, and a lot of people, I think I shut a lot of people out. You know, I was young and I got Mr. Lizza was with the family for so long, I kind of stayed with one outfit, and a lot, I had one or two or three of the old public people that had been with us for years, but I kind of shut a lot of people out as far as they didn't think I was accessible to train horses other than for Flying Z. So it was a little bit of a different time period, and maybe I made a wrong move after having so much success by not just opening the stable more as a public stable. So, even though I've been doing it a long time, now that he passed away, Mr. Lizza, unfortunately, a year and a half ago, it feels like I'm starting from scratch here the last year and a half trying to rebuild and actually having, probably for the first time since those years, a real public stable. So it's definitely a challenge try to get horses. You never thought you'd worry about getting horses or getting the barn filled because, like you said, you have confidence in your ability that you're going to be able to get the job done no matter what kind of horse you're given. You get that, you know, innate thing from my dad and my grandfather, and I've had enough success where you never thought you'd have to worry about, oh, I got to call somebody and get horses to train. But it's a different game now. It's at 44. I feel like a veteran, and I feel like I'm starting over again. So it's definitely interesting.
Yeah. How do you go about that, Carlos, trying to get new owners and new horses into your barn?
Well, I've been, like I said, fortunate that I did build up such a good reputation at a young age, and that's all that my dad always stressed, that all you have is your reputation. So I've been able to slowly, like I said, it's been a big transition losing Mr. Lizza. You know, he's such a stalwart of New York racing for all those years. But slowly, you know, some owners that were in the past, that were my grandfather, you know, a couple of people started giving us horses again. Mr. Newman, Don Newman, a guy who's been a breeder here for years. He's got a nice Sky Mesa filly and a City Zip filly he's going to send us. And then Mark Holliday, a new owner that was with Dale Romans for a number of years, gave us a few horses about 4 years ago, and we started doing really good for him. So he's got four or five nice babies for this year, Blue Devil Racing. So it's just slowly building it back up, and hopefully, you know, we'll get up to 25 or 30 again. Right now we have 15 horses for the winter until the babies come. Last year, like I said, was a big transition year. We won 24 races in the sixth straight year. We made over $1 million in purses with a very modest stable. But this year we have 10 or 15 nice two-year-olds for different people that are getting into the business. So hopefully we'll get it built back up again and keep the Martin name going here for a little bit longer.
Yeah, you know, we always hear a lot in the sport about, you know, trying to attract new owners and that, you know, owners aren't as willing to get into the sport as they used to be back in the day, for example. But has training horses become more competitive in terms of trying to get those owners?
I think so, yes. I think years ago when my grandfather was the leading trainer and there was limits, and it would be more like he was 10 straight years number one in New York, he'd have 40 horses, and that would be it. Woody Stevens would have 36, and that would be it. And then they'd help their friends or they'd recommend somebody else. Now it seems you have four or five of the super trainers, which, don't get me wrong, they've had so much success, you're not going to knock Coca-Cola, but it seems like those four or five guys has become, for the really rich people getting in the business, you know, those three or four or five guys, especially in New York, seem like they have 80, 90, 100 horses, and it's more like a social thing. Who's your trainer? Well, it's like a cocktail party. They, you know, I gave the trainer, you know. So a lot of times the trainers that aren't in the headlight and the spotlight, like those guys, have really dominated the sport. And because the stall situation has opened up and it's a whole different ball game, so you can have a trainer now with 180 horses. When my granddad was number one, he could have maybe gotten 100, but it was a different thing and there was limits and rules. Now you have four different divisions, so it's a little different. Yeah, there's no doubt that the way the game is played now, it's definitely a big difference than it used to be back in the 80s and 90s when he was dominating.
Is there an ideal number of horses that you would like to have in your barn?
Well, I think the way I was raised and watching them do it, you know, to be there and do it right and know exactly everything that's going on, I don't think, you know, if you have 30 or 35 horses, I think that's pretty, that's enough horses for you to do a good job and be able to talk to your owners without a fax or an email and tell them exactly everything that happened on that day. That's kind of where I would be comfortable at, no more than 35.
And you've chosen to stay in the New York area with your stable. Is that a decision that you made based on which factors?
Well, I was raised here. I have all my family here. My wife owns a beauty salon here about 30 minutes away. You know, I'm a New York guy. I'm not opposed to going to Florida for the winter when you get that kind of stock. Last year, I went a little bit to Florida for Mark with the Blue Devil horses with a few of them here and there. But I think New York, you know, is where I'm most comfortable. The purses are great. You know, trying to get New York breeds in the program, they don't give away the money they give away in a maiden here. In the winter, for example, they give away $50,000 in a maiden special New York bred race. And, you know, you go to Florida, you have to run for 43 against, you know, seven horses, Todd, Clement, Chug, that are million-dollar horses in a maiden race. So, you know, my roots are in New York, and that's where I really want to stay.
How about your wife? Is she into racing as well?
She dabbled a little bit when we've been married 7 or 8 years now, and she enjoys it. She likes more the social aspect of getting the summers off and going to Saratoga. I think that's what she really enjoys. But, you know, she understands some things of the business. There's a lot of things that she doesn't understand in the business. You know, she wants to try to bring the outside. She doesn't understand a lot of the way the business practices are for the billing and stuff like that. So we kind of have some interesting discussions in the evening after a long day's work.
Hey, I'm going to go out on a limb and say you probably didn't meet her on the track then.
Exactly. No, I did not. No.
You know, it's interesting because so many trainers will tell me on this program that without the support of their family, and of course their owners, but their family in particular, it would be very difficult to do this job because there are no days off. It's 365 days a year, and you have to be at the barn every day, and that can be taxing.
Oh, yeah, no. She was mad at me a couple of weeks ago because we've been wanting to go away, and there's never the right time to go away because when you're not winning, you have to really buckle down or people have to see you're there. When you're not winning, when you're winning, you want to keep it going. There's never like the momentum has to keep going at all or try to get it going, you know, in this business with so many ups and downs. So she was mad that we hadn't gone away since our honeymoon. So she finally dragged me to Costa Rica about 2 weeks ago and I went kicking and screaming. So yeah, it's not easy.
You went kicking and screaming to Costa Rica.
Yes.
Wow, there's some issues at play here, Carlos. We're not going to get
no
into that now.
She's like, you want to be 16 below in New York? She was making fun because the day we arrived there was like 85. It's like paradise, deja vu every day, 85 and sunny, 85 and sunny, 85 and sunny. So she was giving me a hard time while she was by the pool.
Talk about some of the horses you've trained that stick out most to you.
Well, I think By the Firm, obviously, because she won a grade one, was a great horse. I think back in the 90s, when I was on that roll, I had Stacy's Toy from Mr. Sainer, a breeder that's still around in Florida that I won the Pimlico Oaks with Stacy's Toy. She was a great, great filly. We won the Genuine Risk when Egra Prado was still in Maryland, and we won the Pimlico Oaks with her. We beat a great filly from Buckland Farm that day. So she was an exciting filly to have. That year we had two good fillies that we both sold subsequently to Arthur Appleton's Moonlight Martini and Stacy's Toy, and they both won, I think, 5 or 6 or 7 stakes that year. Those were really two really nice fillies that we had for Mr. Sainer. And, you know, we had that horse that I bought from Christiana and Billy Badgett that we won the Bold Ruler with. Was a very nice horse that unfortunately had an accident racing in the Grade 1 Carter, but he could have been any kind of horse, a Damascus horse called Rousing Past. He was one of my favorite horses back in the day. We won the Bold Ruler Handicap with Nick Santagato with him, and he was a great horse. And then later on, you know, we had Roar Emotion for Mr. Joe Allen, and then Dad was already getting sick, and I took her over, and we won the Black Eyed Susans with her, with John Velasquez. In 2002, we beat Bob Baffert's great filly that he had there for the Lewises. You know, we had some really good fillies. We've been fortunate with fillies more often, I think, than with colts. You know, my dad always was very lucky with fillies. Besides, you know, he won 3 Frisettes with Lakeville Miss. He won the Frisette 75-1 when he beat the great filly from Lucas Terlingua at Gulferette. You know, that race is such a hard race to win, and to win it 3 times the way he won it with mediocre fillies on pedigree was just, you know, incredible.
You mentioned a couple of jockeys throughout the course of this interview tonight, Julie Crone, Nick Santagato. Do you have a go-to rider that when you need a big win, you say, this is who I want to have in the saddle?
I've had luck with Castellano, but I think everybody has the last couple of years. I think he's an amazing jockey when the money's down. And one of my best friends growing up in Saratoga, Matt Musiker, is his agent. And, you know, they've really done unbelievable together. So, you know, going forward, if we get those kind of horses again, which is my hope, that's why I keep getting up 7 days a week to get back to those grade one races and stake races. You know, Castellano, I think, is as good as it gets right now in the country.
So what does Carlos Martin like to do when you're not at the track? And we mentioned not getting a lot of time to go on vacation, but what other hobbies or things do you get into?
Well, I just got home a few minutes ago. I'm going to take my dog, Buddy, for a walk, get some lunch, and get on the iPad, which is something new for me. Like I said, I'm more old school, so my wife got me an iPad about a year ago, so I'm looking at all the races, you know, on the DRF site and all the races coming up, and Ray Pollock's, website and the Thoroughbred Daily News website, and just trying to keep up.
HorseRacingRadio.net, that website too?
Exactly.
Now, you have a pretty nice website yourself. If you go to Carlos Martin Racing, it's a pretty sharp website. And I was looking at that thinking, well, you must embrace this technology. Do you do much with social media or anything like that?
That's a funny story because I never believed in any of that stuff. And now, you know, losing Flying Z, like I said, I'm going through a little bit of a transition. So my brother and my sister have been instrumental in helping me with the business going forward. It's a whole new model. And he's into websites. And he went to NYU. And he's a computer whiz. So he's running with that part of the business. I just let him go.
Well, Carlos, it's been an enjoyable visit here tonight. Time has really flown by. We could have spent another half hour easy, but really appreciate you taking the time and want to wish you all the best moving forward with Carlos Martin Racing.
Thanks again for having me.
Thanks so much, Carlos Martin, here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Great story, great pedigree. Grandfather is a Hall of Famer. Dad conditioned 3 Eclipse champions. He was born to be a trainer. It's that simple. Carlos Martin Racing is the website where you can learn more about Carlos. Second hot half of Trainer Talk coming up next, all presented by Fasig Tipton. Stay tuned.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Where will you be this summer? The Fasig Tipton 2014 yearling sales will be here before we know it, so make plans now. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky will be held July 14th. In 2013, the sale boasted an average of more than $89,000 and a median of $72,000, and the percentage rate of return of 43% was the third highest of any yearling sale in North America. The Saratoga sale on August 4th and 5th is always one of the top international yearling marketplaces. The sales $295,000 average in 2013 maintains its leadership role, and with the highest percentage of profitable yearlings among all sales in North America this past year, it's the only place to be this August. New York bred yearlings are in the spotlight August 9th and 10th in Saratoga with a $430,000 average and major increases in both average and median in 2013. The New York bred sale is the most productive auction for the cream of the New York bred crop. So where will you be this summer?
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Ullman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right. For the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, free guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, breaking news, analysis, and wagering on the go with DRF and DRF Bets Mobile, one-click multi-ticket wagers with DRF Ticketmaker, and now free Daily Racing Form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
HRRN Live brings you live racing from tracks across the country. Join Chad Summers and the HRRN broadcast team as we bring you live racing every Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on our new channel, XM208, or streaming live online at horseracingradio.net. HRRN Live is your source for live thoroughbred racing from coast to coast, only on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Go to hrrnlive.com for a complete schedule of tracks and races.
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Ullman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right. For the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, free guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, breaking news, analysis, and wagering on the go with DRF and DRF Bets Mobile, one-click multi-ticket wagers with DRF Ticketmaker, and now free Daily Racing Form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
This is the Horse Racing Radio Network, your home for racing's biggest events.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. Fun visit in the first half of the program, and really looking forward to our guest here in the second half. Trainer Jimmy Islin has conditioned 356 winners with more than $6 million in purse earnings, and he is now with me here on Trainer Talk tonight. Jimmy, thanks so much for taking the time.
Mike, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, welcome to the show. Happy to have you with me here tonight. Your story is a little different than some trainers, Jimmy. You grew up in a family that could be considered racing and sports royalty.
Well, it's very kind of you. My father was really involved in the operation of Monmouth Park, and he was also involved in the president of the New York Jets. So my real passion was basically horses.
Well, it must have been kind of neat for you growing up around the owner of the New York Jets. Most kids don't get an opportunity to do that.
Well, I'll tell you, the story on the Jets, Mike, was a very unusual one. A friend of mine from California, he lives in California now, Ted Dowd, and I went to a college called Iona, and he went to Fairfield, and we were really great friends. He was he's still around. He's a Mickey Rooney kind of character. He was the manager of Tom Jones. He was Joe Namath's best friend eventually, and I went to the Polo Grounds, and we met Harry Wismer, who was the president of the New York Titan, and he was, to be quite candid, he don't like to talk about the dead, but he was slightly inebriated. And he said, look, I've got real financial problems here. do you know anybody that would want to buy this team? We met with my father and his partner, Sonny Werblin, and told him about this great investment opportunity, and they ended up buying the Jets. It was my father, Sonny Werblin, as I just mentioned, Leon Hess, who was an oil, very successful in the oil business, and Townsend Martin, who owned Great Horses with Tommy Kelly and was a relative of the Phipps family. So they put up $125,000 each. I can say that now, too. And they put another $125,000 to operate the team, and the rest is history. When the Jets won the Super Bowl in 1969, my father was the president. And it was an exciting, very, very exciting to be a part of that. And also horse racing and other sports ventures that I've been involved in.
So the Jets were a competitive team when your dad got involved, or were they not competitive?
Not really. No, it was just the start. They were called, Mike, they were called, when they bought the Jets, they were called the Foolish Club. And I have a picture with the Buffalo Bills, the San Diego Chargers, the Houston Oilers, and the New York Jets, and the Kansas City Chiefs. So they were part of the old American Football League, and which eventually merged with the National Football League. But they were basically, they played in the Polo Grounds, and the Giants were the big team in New York, so nobody much paid attention to the Jets.
How old were you at that point?
Well, I was in my early 20s, my real love was horses, but in college I did my thesis on the three greatest events in sports, and one was the Kentucky Derby, which I ran Royal Roberto in. The other was the Heavyweight Championship of the World, which we promoted that, and we opening in Madison Square Garden, which was when Muhammad Ali was barred from boxing because of his draft stance. And we promoted Buster Mathis and Joe Frazier, who was our fighter. Buster Mathis was our fighter, I'm sorry. And Middleweight Championship of the World, Nino Benvenuti and Emil Griffith. And the New York Jets, so I've been very fortunate to be involved, not always on the winning end of three of the great three, which I wrote about in my thesis. What I wanted to do was the Kentucky Derby, the Heavyweight Championship of the World, and the Super Bowl.
Well, and you came close to achieving so many of those. And I know you stated that when you were around 30 years old or so, you set a couple of unique goals that you wanted to accomplish by the time you turned 40. And one of those was to manage a heavyweight champion of the world, and the other was to win the Kentucky Derby. You came close on both accounts.
Well, Mike, all these, it's very coincidental and ironic. In the boxing world, one of my best friends and mentors was Peter Fuller. And Peter Fuller won the Derby with Dancer's Image. And he had a fighter named Tom McNeely. And we went out to the World's Fair, and Buster Mathis defeated Joe Frazier for the Olympic berth, but got injured, and Joe Frazier went on to win. And because he was so fast, like Muhammad Ali, and extremely big, I thought we decided to sign him. And instead of Joe Frazier, and the rest was history. Buster was a very talented fighter, but Joe Frazier, it was one of the great fights of all time. He fought Muhammad Ali twice, and he was a heavyweight champion. Buster was defeated by Joe Frazier in the opening of the Garden, knocked out in the 10th round.
Yeah, 50-50 chance, Buster Mathis, Joe Frazier. You really couldn't go wrong with either one, but it turned out maybe you could.
But I'm just saying, it's sort of ironic that Peter Fuller really got me interested in boxing, and he was, the manager of Tom McNeely. He also ended up with Dancer's Image winning the Kentucky Derby in the controversial Kentucky Derby.
And then I mentioned you coming close in the Kentucky Derby with Royal Roberto. You made it to the Derby before the age of 40, so you had an opportunity to achieve that goal.
I made it to the Derby. Mike had very good teachers. A lot of them were not these big, were not well-known and big-named trainers. There were people that, they were just great horsemen around New Jersey and around New York, but my major mentor was Jimmy Jones, because he worked for Monmouth Park as the director of racing. So he he really coached me, and we had this two horses, Mike. We had Royal Roberto and Crafty Prospector. Crafty Prospector was a very fast horse, and he ended up being a great sire, but he missed the Derby, and Royal Roberto was, they were both owned by Mitchell Wilson, and I was the trainer, and Jimmy was the racing manager. Royal Roberto was the second choice in the Derby. He was beaten in the Lexington, and then the Calumet, in those days, they always ran in the Derby trial, and he was second in the Derby trial, and he was the second choice in the Derby, and unfortunately, Jeff Bell, who was our rider, was committed to ride Time for a Change, who was the favorite for the Derby. Unfortunately, that horse got colic, and we rode Meek Well Rivera, Mike Rivera, who had won the Derby on Graustark. And what happened was he came into the Derby, and I really had made arrangements with a jockey agent, Jim Reed, to get another mount. He just didn't want to ride except in the Derby. And if I'd have known what I've known now, after Timely Rider got sick, I would have put Jeff Fell back on Royal Roberto and instead of Mike Rivera. So the race was a very dry track, Mike, and it was not speed favoring. And Royal Roberto was a big 17-hand horse, and he sort of sent him up on the lead because I attribute that to not riding the track, and that wasn't his style, and he finished 10th, and Gatto de Sol won the Derby. After we had won the Flamingo, and we really had a, after that he was a New York bred, by the way, because I wanted New York bred even at that early stage, and he won a lot of big races after that. And when Mitchell Wilson passed away, he broke a world's record for a horse in training, $2.1 million, and was bought by Mr. Deschenois that owns Arlington Park, and he raced him. The first day he took him to the track, Mike, he threw the rider off after we had the sale took place at Hialeah. And they had a police escort because he brought so much money back to Gold Street. First day he went to the track, he dumped the rider. He came running back to my barn. So, well, I guess he was telling me he wanted to go home, but he was a very successful racer, of course, and a wonderful horse.
Yeah, and you knew right away that you were high on him from the start, but you knew right away that he had that intangible.
He was a wonderful horse. He could run on the turf and dirt. After the Derby, he was brought to Conquistador Cielo in the Belmont, but he came back and he won the Albany at Saratoga. He was equally as good on the grass as he was on the on the dirt. He was a wonderful horse.
Talking with trainer Jimmy Islin here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Jimmy, you were never particularly comfortable with the somewhat elite or front office upbringing that you had throughout much of your life because of your dad. You always preferred to be in the barns, right?
Well, I said to my father, seeing that we had brought the Jets to be in his partners, could I work in the Jets? He said, no, I don't. He was very sensitive to his son nepotism being involved, and same thing went for Monmouth Park. But he was a wonderful man. He was a member of the Jockey Club, and Mike, he actually was the inventor of the Eclipse Awards, and he won the first Eclipse Award. He had Johnny Carson as the MC, but he was very sensitive to the fact that he did not want people to say that he had his son working at Monmouth and the Jets, and really, really wanted me to make it on my own.
Yeah, well, he was never really in favor of your decision to work around the track, right? He wanted you to be in the front office if you were going to be around.
He wanted me. He had a very everything in our family emanated from was the apparel business. So I decided it was a manufacturing clothes for large size women. And, we didn't everything we had really came from that. And he wanted me in business or to be in Wall Street. And what happened was that I was in the apparel business, sold the largest order on a style to the first $1 million lottery winner was the buyer George Ashton from JCPenney. And by the time one day it was really hot and the tar was sticking on 7th Avenue on my feet, and I said, I had a great thing to fall back on. So it's 11 years old when they took me to the riding academy. By the 12th, when I was 12, I was cleaning out the stalls and worked around every different breed and kind of horse in New Jersey. And I said to my father, I said, this is what I want to do, and hopefully won't embarrass you. And he and Leon Hashford, another gentleman, put the money up, and Lucian Lawrence and Alan Jerkins were nice enough to sell me these horses. And right before my father passed away, Chief Tavanaco won the Bold Roar and broke the track record at Aqueduct, and Simmons' son, John Fitzsimmons, presented me with the trophy. So the motto of the story is, at least he could see his son win a stake or win a race. But they really did not want me in the horse business. One time I was galloping horses at Ballard Park, catch my father and the president of the track. My father was the treasurer at the time, Amory Haskell. And I said, good morning, Mr. Haskell. And you know about the Haskell stakes. The father was a little embarrassed. And then at the Eclipse Awards, I had a horse on the farm, Mike, while I was going to prep school and on a farm in New Jersey, and it won at Garden State, Mike. And Jimmy Jones went up to my mother, and she said, Betty, Jimmy's horse just won at Garden State. And her answer was very, very adamantly, we don't want him in the horse business.
But, wow.
I continued to pursue that goals, and my parents, did eventually, as I just told you, support me.
Yeah, well, I had read somewhere that you referred to the 6 years that you were marketing the women's dresses in your dad's apparel business as the most miserable stretch of your life.
Well, it was tough, but at least to be quite and be upfront and quite candid about it, it was I was a good salesman, and I did have I hopefully had some ability and style, and my wife was a fashion designer, but much better stuff of apparel. But it was very difficult. It was, look, I could understand my father that he wanted me to do that, but I was, to use a saying, was a fish out of water.
Is it true, Jimmy, that you actually got kicked out of prep school because of your love of racing?
Yeah, partially. My father took my roommate, which is Michael Eisner, who was eventually became the president of Disney, Joe DiMaggio Jr., you know who he is. He was the son of the greatest baseball player. John Dos Passos' son, who was a famous author, Chris Hulbert, and Michael Walker, who was Jennifer Jones's. I'm not dropping the names, but they were my roommates. And I said, look, let's go back to the steakhouse ourselves, and I'll show you the horses, where I was at this farm in Princeton, New Jersey. We got caught coming back when we flew the coop, and the president of the student body wanted me to turn everybody in, which I wouldn't do. And because my grades were not the greatest, Mike, I didn't fight hard. My father really wanted me to go to Princeton, but I wasn't a candidate for Princeton. And I got thrown out of Lawrenceville like the catcher in the rye, Holden Caulfield. And I ended up going to school and went to college at Rutgers and Iona. And I literally staggered through college, but I did get a college degree. And my thesis in college was the Kentucky Derby, the heavyweight championship of the world, and the Super Bowl. So that's basically what it was about.
Well, not many people get to hang out with Joe DiMaggio Jr. when they're growing up.
Right. It was amazing. Look, it was, but honestly, I was from Oceanport, New Jersey, where Monmouth Park is, Mike. And it was a very small, I went to a small grammar school, and my father really had this dream, as I said, of me going to Princeton. But I loved horses. That was my passion, and it was a very competitive school, and it was an interesting experience. But on the other hand, as I said, I wasn't Princeton material.
Well, as we talked about, your parents weren't necessarily thrilled with your decision to be a horse trainer and be in the horse business in that respect, but it was two-time Derby winning trainer Jimmy Jones who kind of helped convince your dad, wasn't it?
Well, he worked on him hard, and as I said, I was always told not to. Charlie Whittingham told me not to follow an empty wagon. So, in addition to all the wonderful people that I had worked for, that a lot of your viewers or listeners wouldn't know, I mean, I did have Charlie, Woody, and Jimmy, and his father won the greatest events of the world was Woody winning 5 Belmonts in a row. But Calumet had also won 5 Derbies. So they had a dinner for Woody, Mike, in New York at the 21 Club, and Jimmy Jones said to the press, "What's wrong with you guys?" He said, "Haven't you heard about the Jones boys?" And what they said, but what he said, Jimmy Jones says, "Why, hell, a citation could pull a cart and beat Devil's Bag. Devil's Bag was one of Woody Stevens' great horses." And Woody said back in his inimitable way, "Well, Devil's Bag never got beat at Harvard de Grace. Saggy beat Citation, Mike, at Harvard de Grace." But they were good friends, but they were very competitive.
And there was a point when you were actually driving to Monmouth Park every morning before work to train just one horse, right?
I would go to train one horse named Gratitude, and I bought the picture and showed it to someone. Gratitude was a really nice little horse, and I would go, and it's two horses really. Day is Right and Gratitude. I remember horses better than people, but Gratitude won with Bill Hartek, and Day is Right was a horse that would never come out of the gate, and through Jimmy Jones's tutelage, we got him to break from the gate, and he did win a number of races. He was actually barred from racing here in New York, and then we got him okay, and just brought him to the gate continuously, fed him carrots, made him feel at home. He was a game little horse, but that was my number one priority before work, was to go to Monmouth Park.
Well, I guess the silver lining in working with your dad's company was that you were always a strong believer that horses would thrive when they were closest to their natural state of being in the wild. And you actually developed a horse feed mixture when you were working with your dad?
It was a natural and organic feed. When I was in my teenagers, I became very interested in organic farming and gardening. And much to the, again, to the chagrin of my parents, and we actually started the first net way before Whole Foods, way before all these famous health food stores. We basically went to, we had a natural food store in Red Bank, New Jersey, and then we developed this, it sounds a little egotistical, but we developed this feed called J.I. Feed, and it had natural flaxseed, kelp, soybeans, and it was all organic and natural. It was very palatable. I got somebody to manufacture, and actually a lot of other trainers started using it. And that was one of the things I was proud of. And the horses that I was involved with, and others too, thought it was a good feat.
Trainer Jimmy Islin joining me on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Jimmy, you've obviously been around the game for a while. Has training horses changed since you first got into the business?
It really has. I mean, the breed of horses. Look, I can say, you know, maybe I'm at the tail end of my career or whatever, but I can say that when I started, I mean, we had a huge love of the horses. I would get up at 3 in the morning when I was 14 years old and get on a train to go to these farms, which were near Monmouth Park, the Intrigue, and it was called J.G. Farm, and there's another famous farm named Brookdale Farm, which there's a Brookdale Farm in Kentucky, which Fred Seitzing, he was also involved in that, and we would stay all day. I worked one summer, Mike, when I was going to high school, galloped horses, mucked out stalls, did everything, and the guy was named Buster Bruder. He ended up being the oldest exercise rider in New York. He had worked with Woody Stevens eventually. Worked all summer long. When he said, when he was hungry, I would go to my father's refrigerator or a freezer and bring him a steak. When he needed shoes, I went up to the attic and got him shoes. And at the end of the summer, he gave me a $10 bill, Mike, and he said, look, that's all I can give you. And, you know, I was obviously expecting more, but when I look back at, in retrospect, and to be objective, I couldn't have got that education at Harvard, Princeton, or Yale. So that was in the old days, it was the love of the horse. It was, he rested the horses in the wintertime. It was, as we all know it, the sport of kings. And now, you know, the business is dramatically different. But I still go by the axioms that I was taught, that the best is not good enough for your horses. And as Charlie Whittingham said, they're like strawberries. They have a short shelf life, so you have to be very patient. But I do remember and respect the past. And I knew there were great horsemen then, and great, great horses. And the breed was much more sturdy. There was no, the medication was, there was no real medication. And it was a wonderful era to be around horses. And New Jersey was a very, very big horse country. And it was great.
Who was the trainer that you looked up to the most, Jimmy?
Well, I got to say one thing. It's a dead heat. Like Woody, I mentioned it before. Woody, Jimmy Jones, because he took such an interest in me, and Charlie Whittingham. I mean, they knew how to develop horses. They had an unbelievable touch. And Jimmy Jones's father, Mike, who I never knew, I have a picture of 40 horses with the riders on them out in the field. And Woody was very respectful of Ben Jones, and he said that he could go out with 40 horses instinctively. No, take this one back to the barn. Don't train. Jog this one. He was a great horseman. I wish I would have been born a little bit earlier. You know, I would have even seen that. But those three trainers are the ones that stick out in my mind as, you know, that I was involved with and I knew, and their record speaks for itself.
Jimmy, only a couple of minutes left, but I do want to ask you about the Island Handicap at Monmouth. That's a very historic race, and it is one that is named after your family. What does that mean to you growing up in that area?
Look, my father was a wonderful man. I could never be him. It's a tough act to follow, Mike. But after he passed away, Barney Nagler, who was a very well-known sports writer and worked for the Daily Racing Form, he was adamant about naming the race after my father. And it's every year to be there and to go down there. And he, in the cemetery where he's buried, he's right across the street. I visited that, and it's a wonderful honor for my father's name to be recognized. And he was a great, great man, and he loved racing, and it's a thrill.
Are you still a New York Jets fan?
Well, not really. I tried to win the Island once with a horse called Gourley, but Lady Secret won it, and we were fourth. But the only problem, Mike, there was only four horses in the race. And as far as the Jets go, my father, the coach, walked out on the team, Lou Holtz, with a couple games left to play. And my father, I was driving down to Monmouth Park, down to my house in New Jersey with Jimmy Jones. My father actually passed away trying to sign a new coach to replace Lou Holtz. So really, it was a very big shock, even though it was not unexpected, because he had a heart attack in Denver, a mile-high altitude. And everybody came down. Howard Cosell did the eulogy, and everybody from football and the racing world did come down to that. But after that happened, I really lost the interest in the Jets.
Well, Jimmy, this has been a really enjoyable visit. I can't tell you how much it means to me that you took the time to tell your story, and can't thank you enough. And I want to wish you all the best moving forward, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, Mike, and it means a lot to me that you know, call me and do this interview. I look forward to speaking to you and seeing you soon.
Jimmy, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Jimmy Island, amazing story. Some of the things you just don't know about this great sport. There's so many great storylines, and that's what we try to do here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. We try to bring those to you each and every week. You can tune in 6 o'clock Eastern Time, Sirius 93 XM 208. That's every single Wednesday night for this Trainer Talk show. I want to say a special thank you to Carlos Martin for joining me in the first half of the program. Jimmy Islin here in the second half. I want to thank my producer, Lee Della Pina, doing a great job. I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time here on Trainer Talk.